This is Audible Kids!
Listening Library presents Ink Death by Cornelia Funke. Read for you by Alan Cordura. Chapter 1. Nothing but a dog and a sheet of paper. Moonlight fell on Eleanor's bathrobe, her nightdress, her bare feet, and the dog lying in front of them. Orpheus's dog. Oh, the way he looked at her with his eternally sad eyes, as if asking himself why, in the name of all the exciting smells in the world, she was sitting in her library in the middle of the night, surrounded by silent books, just staring into space.
"Why?" said Eleanor in the silence. "Because I can't sleep, you stupid animal."
But she patted his head all the same.
"This is what you've come to, Eleanor," she thought as she hauled herself out of her armchair. "Spending your nights talking to a dog. You don't even like dogs, least of all this one, with his heavy breathing that always reminds you of his appalling master."
Still, she had kept the dog, in spite of the painful memories he brought back. She'd kept the chair, too, even though the magpie had sat in it. Mortola. How often Eleanor thought she heard the old woman's voice when she went into the quiet library. How often she seemed to see Mortimer and Risa standing among the bookshelves, or Maggie sitting by the window with a book on her lap, face hidden behind her smooth, bright hair. Memories. They were all she had left. No more tangible than the pictures conjured up by books. But what would be left if she lost those memories too? Then she'd be alone again forever, with the silence and the emptiness in her heart, and an ugly dog. Her feet looked so old in the pale moonlight. Moonlight, she thought, wiggling her toes in it. In many stories, moonlight had magical powers. All lies. Her whole head was full of printed lies. She couldn't even look at the moon with eyes unclouded by veils of letters. Couldn't she wipe all those words out of her head and heart and see the world through her own eyes again, at least once? "Heavens, Eleanor, what a fabulous mood you're in," she thought, as she made her way over to the glass case where she kept everything that Orpheus had left behind, apart from his dog. Wallowing in self-pity, like that stupid dog rolling over in every puddle. The sheet of paper that lay behind the glass looked like nothing special, just an ordinary piece of lined paper, densely written in pale blue ink. Not to be compared with the magnificently illuminated books in the other display cases, even though the tracing of every letter showed how very impressed Orpheus was with himself. I hope the fire elves have burned that self-satisfied smile off his lips, thought Eleanor as she opened the glass case. I hope the men-at-arms have skewered him, or even better, I hope he's starved to death in the Wayless Wood, miserably and very, very slowly. It wasn't the first time she had pictured to herself Orpheus's wretched end in the ink world. These images gave her lonely heart more pleasure than almost anything. The sheet of paper was already yellowing. To add insult to injury, it was cheap stuff, and the words on it really didn't look as though they could have spirited their writer away to another world right before Eleanor's eyes. Three photographs lay beside the sheet of paper, one of Maggie and two of Risa. A photo of her as a child, and another taken only a few months ago, with Mortimer beside her, both of them smiling so happily. Hardly a night went by when Eleanor didn't look at those photographs. By now, at least, the tears had stopped running down her cheeks when she did so. But they were still there in her heart. Bitter tears. Her heart was full to the brim with them. A horrible feeling. Lost. Maggie. Risa, Mortimer. Almost 3 months had passed since their disappearance. In fact, Maggie had even been gone a few days longer than her parents. The dog stretched and came trotting drowsily over to her. He pushed his nose into her bathrobe pocket,
knowing there were always a few dog biscuits in it for him.
"Yes, all right, all right," she murmured, shoving one of the smelly little things into his broad muzzle. "Where's your master, then?"
She held the sheet of paper in front of his nose, and the stupid creature sniffed it as if he could really catch Orpheus's scent behind the words on the page. Eleanor stared at the words, shaping them with her lips. "In the streets of Ombra." She'd stood here so often over the last few weeks, surrounded by books that meant nothing to her. Now she was once again alone with them. They didn't speak to her, just as if they knew that she'd have exchanged them all on the spot for the three people she had lost. Lost in a book.
"I will learn how, damn it."
Her voice sounded defiant, like a child's.
"I'll learn how to read them so that they'll swallow me up too. I will, I will."
The dog was looking at her as if he believed every word of it. But Eleanor didn't. Not a single one. No, she was no silver tongue. Even if she tried for a dozen years or more, the words wouldn't make music when she spoke them. She'd loved words so much all her life, although they didn't sing for her the way they sang for Meggie or Mortimer. Or Orpheus, damn him, three times over. The piece of paper shook in her fingers as she started to cry. Here came the tears again. She'd held them back for so long, all the tears in her heart, until it was simply overflowing with them. Eleanor's sobs were so loud that the dog cowered in alarm. How ridiculous that water ran out of your eyes when your heart hurt. Tragic heroines in books tended to be amazingly beautiful. Not a word about swollen eyes or a red nose.
"Crying always gives me a red nose," thought Eleanor. "I expect that's why I'll never be in any book."
"Eleanor," she spun around, hastily wiping away her tears. Darius stood in the open doorway, wearing the bathrobe that she had given him for his last birthday. It was much too large for him.
"What is it?" she snapped. "Where had that handkerchief gone this time?"
Sniffing, she pulled it from her sleeve and blew her nose.
"3 months! They've been gone 3 months now, Darius! Isn't that a good reason to cry?" "Yes, it is. Don't look at me so pityingly with your owlish eyes. Never mind how many books we buy," she said with a wide sweep of her arm toward her well-filled shelves. "Never mind how many we get at auctions, swap, or steal. Not one of them tells me what I want to know. Thousands of pages, and not a word on any of them with news of the only people I want to know about. Why would I be interested in anything else? Theirs is the only story I want to hear. How is Meggie now, do you think? How are Risa and Mortimer? Are they happy, Darius? Are they still alive? Will I ever see them again?"
Darius looked along the books, as if the answer might after all be found in one of them. But then, like all those printed pages, he gave her no answer. "I'll make you some hot milk and honey," he said at last, disappearing into the kitchen. And Eleanor was alone again with the books, the moonlight, and Orpheus's ugly dog. Chapter 2. Only a Village. The fairies were already beginning to dance among the trees, swarms of tiny blue bodies. Their wings caught the starlight, and Mo saw the Black Prince glancing anxiously at the sky. It was still as dark as the surrounding hills, but the fairies were never wrong. On a cold night like this, only the coming of dawn could lure them from their nests, and the village whose harvest the robbers were trying to save this time lay dangerously close to Ombra. As soon as daybreak came, they must be gone. A village like many others. Only a dozen poor huts, a few barren stony fields, and a wall that would hardly keep out a child, let alone a soldier. 30 women without their menfolk, 3 dozen fatherless children. 2 days ago, the new governor's men had carried off almost the entire harvest of the neighboring village. The robbers had reached the place too late, but something could still be salvaged here. They'd spent hours digging, showing the women how to hide livestock and provisions underground. The strong man was carrying the last hastily dug sackful of potatoes, his rough-hewn face red with effort. It turned the same color when he was fighting or drunk. Between them all, they lowered the sack into the hiding place they had made just beyond the fields,
and Mo covered the entrance with a network of twigs to hide the storage pit from soldiers and tax gatherers. By now, toads were croaking in the surrounding hills, as if to entice out the day, and the men on watch among the huts were getting restless. They'd seen the fairies, too. High time to get away, back into the forest where a hiding place could always be found, even though the new governor was sending more and more patrols out to the hills. The Milksop, the widows of Ombra called him. A good nickname for the Adderhead's puny brother-in-law. But the Milksop's greed for what few possessions his new subjects had was insatiable. Mo rubbed his eyes. Heavens, he was tired. He'd hardly slept for days. There were just too many villages that they might yet be able to reach ahead of the soldiers. "You look worn out," Risa had said only yesterday when she woke up beside him, unaware that he hadn't come to bed beside her until the first light of dawn. He had said something about bad dreams, told her he'd been passing the sleepless hours by working on the book he was binding, a collection of her drawings of fairies and glass men. He hoped Risa and Meggie would be asleep again now, when he came back to the lonely farmhouse that the Black Prince had found for them. It was east of Ombra, an hour's journey from the city on foot, and far from the land where the Adderhead still ruled, made immortal by a book that Mo had bound with his own hands. "Soon," thought Mo, "soon the book won't protect him anymore." But how often had he told himself that before? And the Adderhead was still immortal. A girl hesitantly approached Mo. How old would she be, 6, 7? Her hair was as blonde as Meggie's, but it was a long time since Meggie had been so small. Shyly, she stopped a pace away from him. Snapper emerged from the darkness and went over to the child.
"Yes, go on, take a good look," he whispered to the little girl. "That's really him, the blue jay. He eats children like you for supper."
Snapper loved such jokes. Mo bit back the words on the tip of his tongue.
"Don't believe a word he says," he told her in a low voice. "Why aren't you asleep like everyone else?"
The child looked at him. Then she pushed up his sleeve with her small hands until the scar showed. The scar of which the songs told tales. She looked at him, wide-eyed, with the same mixture of awe and fear he had now seen in so many faces. The blue jay. The girl ran back to her mother, and Mo straightened up. Whenever his chest hurt where Mortola had wounded him, he felt as if the blue jay, the robber to whom Fenolio had given Mo's face and voice, had slipped in there to join him. Or had the blue jay always been a part of him, merely sleeping until Fenolio's world brought him to life? Sometimes when they were taking meat or a few sacks of grain stolen from the Milksop's bailiffs to one of the starving villages, women would come up to him and kiss his hand. "Go and thank the Black Prince, not me," he always told them. But the prince just laughed.
"Get yourself a bear," he said. "Then they'll leave you alone."
A child began crying in one of the huts. A tinge of red was showing in the night sky, and Mo thought he heard hoofbeats. Horsemen, at least a dozen of them, maybe more. How fast the ears learned to tell what sounds meant, much faster than it took the eyes to decipher written words. The fairies scattered. Women cried out and ran to the huts where their children slept. Mo's hand drew his sword as if of its own accord, as if it had never done anything else. It was the sword he had taken from the Castle of Night, the sword that once belonged to Firefox. The first light of dawn. Wasn't it said that they always came at first light because they loved the red of the sky? With any luck, they'd be drunk after one of their master's endless banquets. The prince signaled to the robbers to take up their positions surrounding the village. It was only a couple of courses of flat stones, and the huts wouldn't offer much protection either. The bear was snorting and grunting, and here they came now, out of the darkness. Horsemen, more than a dozen of them, with the new crest of Ombra on their breasts, a basilisk on a red background. They had not, of course, been expecting to find men here. Weeping women, crying children, yes, but not men, and armed men at that. Taken aback, they reined in their horses. They were drunk. Good, that would slow them down. They didn't hesitate for long, seeing at once that they were far better armed than the ragged robbers. And they had horses. Fools, they'd die before they realized that weapons and horses weren't all that counted.
Every last one of them, Snapper whispered hoarsely to Mo. We have to kill them all, Blue Jay. I hope your soft heart understands that. If a single man gets back to Umbra, this village will burn tomorrow.
Mo merely nodded, as if he didn't know. The horses neighed shrilly as their riders urged them toward the robbers, and Mo felt it again, just as he had on Mount Adder when he had killed Buster. That coldness of the blood. Cold as the hoarfrost at his feet. The only fear he felt was fear of himself. But then came the screams, the groans, the blood. His own heartbeat, loud and much too fast, striking and thrusting, pulling his sword out of the bodies of strangers, the blood of strangers wet on his clothes, faces distorted by hatred. Or was it fear? Fortunately, you couldn't see much under their helmets. They were so young. Smashed limbs, smashed human beings.
Careful! Watch out! Behind you! Kill! Fast! Not one of them must get away! Blue Jay!
One of the soldiers whispered the name before Mo struck him down. Perhaps he had been thinking with his last breath of all the silver he'd get for bringing the Blue Jay's body back to Umbra Castle. More silver than he could ever take as loot in a whole lifetime as a soldier. Mo pulled his sword out of the man's chest. They had come without their body armor. Who needed armor against women and children? How cold killing made you. Very cold. Although your own skin was burning and your blood was flowing fever hot. They did indeed kill them all. It was quiet in the huts as they threw the bodies over the precipice. Two were their own men, whose bones would now mingle with those of their enemies. There was no time to bury them. The Black Prince had a nasty cut on his shoulder. Mo bandaged it as best he could. The bear sat beside them, looking anxious. The child came out of one of the huts, the little girl who had pushed up his sleeve. From a distance, she really did look like Maggie. Maggie, Risa, he hoped they'd still be asleep when he got back. How was he going to explain all the blood if they weren't? So much blood.
Sometime, Mortimer, he thought, the nights will overshadow the days. Nights of blood. Peaceful days. Days when Maggie showed him everything she had only been able to tell him about in the tower of the Castle of Night. Nymphs with scaly skins dwelling in blossom-covered pools. Footprints of giants long gone. Flowers that whispered when you touched them. Trees growing right up to the sky. Moss women who appeared between their roots as if they had peeled away from the bark. Peaceful days. Nights of blood. They did what they could to cover up the traces of the fight, and left, taking the horses with them. There was a note of fear in the stammered thanks of the village women as they left. They'd seen with their own eyes that their allies knew as much about killing as their enemies did. Snapper rode back to the robbers' camp with the horses and most of the men. The camp was moved almost daily. At present, it was in a dark ravine that became hardly any lighter even by day. They would send for Roxanne to tend the wounded, while Mo went back to where Risa and Maggie were sleeping at the deserted farm. The prince had found it for them, because Risa didn't want to stay in the robbers' camp, and Maggie too longed for a house to live in after all those homeless weeks. The Black Prince accompanied Mo, as he so often did.
Of course, the Blue Jay never travels without a retinue, mocked Snapper before they parted company.
Mo, whose heart was still racing from all the killing, could have dragged him off his horse for that, but the prince restrained him. They travelled on foot. It meant a painfully long walk for their tired limbs, but their footprints were harder to follow than a trail left by horses' hooves. And the farm must be kept safe, for everything Mo loved was waiting there. The house and the dilapidated farm buildings always appeared among the trees as unexpectedly as if someone had dropped and lost them there. There was no trace now of the fields where food for the farm had once been grown, and the path that used to lead to the nearest village had disappeared long ago. The forest had swallowed up everything. Here it was no longer called the Wayless Wood, the name it bore south of Ombra. Here the forest had as many names as there were local villages. The Fairy Forest, the Dark Wood, the Moss Women's Wood. If the strong man was to be believed, the place where the Blue Jay's hideout lay was called Larkwood.
Larkwood? Nonsense, was Meggie's response to that. The strong man calls everything after birds. He even gives birds' names to the fairies, although they can't stand the birds. Batista says it's called the Wood of Lights, which suits it much better. Did you ever see so many glowworms and fire elves in a wood? And all those fireflies that sit in the treetops at night?
Whatever the name of the wood, Mo was always captivated afresh by the peace and quiet under its trees. It reminded him that this, too, was a part of the Ink World, as much a part of it as the milksop's soldiers. The first of the morning sun was filtering through the branches, dappling the trees with pale gold, and the fairies were dancing as if intoxicated in the cold autumn sunlight. They fluttered into the bear's furry face until he hit out at them. The prince held one of the little creatures to his ear, smiling as if he could understand what its sharp, shrill little voice was saying. Had the other world been like this? Why could he hardly remember? Had life there been the same beguiling mixture of darkness and light, cruelty and beauty? So much beauty that it sometimes almost made you drunk. The Black Prince had the farm guarded by his men day and night. Gecko was one of the guards today. As Mo and the prince came through the trees, he emerged from the ruined pigsty, a morose expression on his face. Gecko was always on the move. He was a small man whose slightly protuberant eyes had earned him his name. One of his tame crows was perched on his shoulder. The prince used the crows as messengers, but most of the time they stole for Gecko from the markets. The amount they could carry away in their beaks always amazed Mo. When he saw the blood on their clothes, Gecko turned pale. But the shadows of the Inkworld had obviously left the isolated farm untouched again last night. Mo almost fell over his own feet with weariness as he walked toward the well. The prince reached for his arm, although he too was swaying with exhaustion. "It was a close shave this time," he said quietly, as if the peace were an illusion that would be shattered by his voice. "If we're not more careful, the soldiers will be waiting for us in the next village. The price the Adderhead has set on your head is high enough to buy all of Ombra. I can hardly trust my own men any more, and by this time even the children in the villages recognize you. Perhaps you ought to lie low here for a while." Mo shooed away the fairies whirring in the air above the well, then let the wooden bucket down. "Nonsense. They recognize you too." The water in the depths below shone as if the moon were hiding there from morning. "Like the well outside Merlin's cottage," thought Mo, as he cooled his face with the clear water and cleaned the cut that a soldier had given him on his forearm. "All we need now is for Archimedes to fly up on my shoulder, while Wart comes stumbling out of the wood." "What are you smiling at?" The Black Prince leaned on the edge of the well beside Mo, while his bear lumbered around, snuffling on ground that was wet with dew. "A story I once read." Mo put the bucket of water down for the bear. "I'll tell it to you sometime. It's a good story, even though it has a sad ending." But the prince shook his head and passed his hand over his tired face. "If it ends sadly, I don't want to hear it." Gecko wasn't the only man who had been guarding the sleeping farm. Mo smiled when Batista stepped out of the tumble-down barn. Batista had no great opinion of fighting, but Mo liked him and the strong man best of all the robbers, and he found it easier to go out at night if one of them was watching over Risa and Meggie. Batista still did his clown act at fairs, even when his audience had hardly a penny to spare. "We don't want them forgetting how to laugh altogether," he said, when Snapper mocked him for it. He liked to hide his pockmarked face behind the masks he made for himself. Laughing masks, weeping masks, whatever he felt like at the time. But when he joined Mo at the well, he handed him not a mask, but a bundle of black clothes.
"A very good morning to you, Blue Jay," he said, with the same deep bow that he made to his audience. "Sorry I took rather a long time with your order, but I ran out of thread. Like everything else, it's hard to get in Umbra. But luckily, Gecko here," he added, bowing in the man's direction, "sent one of his black-feathered friends off to steal me a few reels from one of the market traders. Thanks to our new governor, they're still rich."
"Black clothes?" The prince looked inquiringly at Mo. "What for?"
"A bookbinder's garments. Binding books is still my trade, or have you forgotten? What's more, black is good camouflage by night." "As for this," said Mo, stripping off his blood-stained shirt, "I'd better dye it black too, or I can't very well wear it again."
The prince looked at him thoughtfully.
"I'll say it again, even though you don't want to listen. Lie low here for a few days. Forget the outside world, just as the world has forgotten this farm."
The anxiety in his dark face touched Mo, and for a moment he was almost tempted to give the bundle back to Batista. But only almost. When the prince had gone, Mo hid the shirt and his blood-stained trousers in the former bakehouse, now converted into his workshop, and put on the black clothes. They fit perfectly, and he was wearing them as he slipped back into the house just as the morning made its way in through the unglazed windows. Meggie and Risa were still asleep. A fairy had lost her way in the gloom of Meggie's room. Mo lured her to his hand with a few quiet words.
"Will you look at that?" Snapper always used to say. "Even the damn fairies love his voice. Looks like I'm the only person not to fall under its spell."
Mo carried the fairy over to the window and let her flutter out. He pulled Meggie's blanket up over her shoulders, the way he used to on all those nights when he and she had only each other. And he glanced at her face. How young she still looked when she was asleep. Awake, she seemed so much more grown up. She whispered a name in her sleep. "Farid." Was it when you fell in love for the first time that you grew up?
"Where have you been?"
Mo spun around. Risa was standing in the open doorway, rubbing sleep from her eyes.
"Watching the fairies' morning dance. The nights are getting colder now. Soon they'll hardly leave their nests at all."
It wasn't exactly a lie, and the sleeves of the black tunic were long enough to hide the cut on his forearm.
"Come with me, or we'll wake this big daughter of ours."
He drew her with him into the bedroom where they slept.
"What kind of clothes are those?"
"A bookbinder's outfit. Batista made it for me, black as ink. Suitable, don't you think? I've asked him to make you and Meggie something, too. You'll be needing another dress soon."
He put his hand on her belly. You couldn't see it yet. A new child, brought with them from the old world, although they had found out only in this one. It was barely a week since Risa had told him.
"Which would you like?" she'd asked. "A daughter or a son?" "Can I choose?" he had replied,
trying to imagine what it would be like to hold tiny fingers in his hand again, so tiny that they could scarcely grasp his thumb. It was just the right time, before Meggie was so grown up that he could hardly call her a child at all.
"The sickness is getting worse. I'll ride over to see Roxanne later. She's sure to know what to do for it." "Yes, she's sure to know."
Mo took her in his arms. Peaceful days. Nights of blood. Chapter 3. Written Silver. Of course, Orpheus did none of the digging himself. He stood there in his fine clothes, watching Farid sweat. He had made him dig in two places already, and the hole Farid was excavating now was already deep enough to come up to his chest. The dirt was moist and heavy. It had rained a great deal these last few days, and the shovel was useless. In addition, there was a hanged man dangling right above Farid's head. The cold wind swung the body back and forth on its rotting rope. Suppose it fell and buried him under its decaying bones. Three more somber figures swung from the gallows on Farid's right. Milksop, the new governor, liked hanging people. Folk said that he had his wigs made from the hair of executed men and women. And the widows in Ombra whispered that this was the reason why so many women had been condemned to hang.
"How much longer are you going to take? It's getting light. Hurry up, dig faster,"
Orpheus snapped, kicking a skull down into the pit. Skulls lay beneath the gallows like terrible fruits. It was true that day was beginning to dawn. Damn that cheese-face. He'd had Farid digging almost all night long. If only he could wring the man's pale neck.
"Faster! Get your fine bodyguard to do some digging for a change,"
Farid shouted up to him.
"Then his muscles would at least be some use."
The chunk folded his bulky arms and smiled down with derision. Orpheus had found the giant working for a physician in the marketplace, holding down the man's customers while he pulled out their rotten teeth.
"What on earth are you going on about now?"
was all Orpheus had said condescendingly when Farid asked why he needed another servant.
"Even the rag and bone men in Ombra have bodyguards to protect them from the riffraff roaming the streets, and I'm a good deal richer than they are."
In this he was certainly right. And as Orpheus offered better pay than the physician, and the chunk's ears hurt from listening to all those screams of agony, he went with them without a word. He called himself Os, a very short name for such a large fellow, but it suited a man who spoke so seldom that at first Farid could have sworn he had no tongue in his ugly mouth. However, that mouth worked overtime at eating, and more frequently the chunk would devour what Orpheus's maids put in front of Farid, too. At first, he had complained. But after Os lay in wait for him on the cellar steps one night, Farid preferred to sleep on an empty stomach, or steal something from the marketplace. The chunk had made life in Orpheus's service even worse. A handful of pieces of broken glass inside Farid's straw mattress, a leg stuck out to trip him up at the bottom of a staircase, a sudden rough hand grasping his hair. He had to be on his guard against Os all the time. There was no peace from him except at night, when the man slept outside Orpheus's bedroom, docile as a dog.
"Bodyguards don't dig," Orpheus explained in a weary tone, pacing impatiently up and down between the holes Farid had dug. "And if you go on dawdling like that, we really will need a bodyguard. They're bringing two poachers here to hang before noon." "Well, there you are then. I keep telling you. Let's just look for buried treasure behind your house."
The hills where gallows stood, graveyards, burned-out farms. Orpheus loved places that sent a shiver down Farid's spine. Cheeseface certainly wasn't afraid of ghosts. You had to give him that. Farid wiped the sweat out of his eyes.
"You might at least write a more detailed description of which damn gallows the treasure's under. And why does it have to be buried so deep, for heaven's sake?"
"Why buried so deep? Why not behind my house?" Orpheus pursed his girlishly soft lips scornfully. "What an original idea.
Does that sound as if it belongs in this story? Even Fenolia wouldn't fall for such nonsense. But why do I bother to keep explaining? You wouldn't understand anyway."
"Oh, no?" Farid drove his shovel so deep into the damp soil that it stuck.
"Well, there is one thing I understand very well. While you're writing yourself treasure after treasure, acting the rich merchant and chasing every maid in Ombra, Dustfinger still lies among the dead."
Farid felt tears come to his eyes yet again. The pain was as fresh now as it had been on the night when Dustfinger died for him. If he could only forget that still face. If he could only remember Dustfinger as he was in life. But he kept seeing him lying in the abandoned mine, cold and silent, his heart frozen.
"I'm sick and tired of being your servant," he shouted up at Orpheus.
In his fury, he even forgot the hanged men, whose ghosts certainly wouldn't like so much shouting in the place where they had died.
"You haven't kept your end of the bargain. Instead of bringing Dustfinger back, you've made yourself as comfortable in this world as a maggot in a side of bacon. You've buried him like all the others. Fenolio's right. You're about as much use as a perfumed pig's bladder. I'm going to tell Maggie to send you back again, and she'll do it. Just you wait and see."
Os looked inquiringly at Orpheus, his eyes asking permission to seize Farid and beat him black and blue, but Orpheus ignored him.
"Ah, so we're back to that subject," he said, barely able to control his voice. "The amazing, wonderful Meggie, daughter of an equally fabulous father who answers to the name of a bird these days, hiding out in the forest with a band of verminous robbers, while ragged minstrels make up song after song about him."
Orpheus adjusted his glasses and looked up at the sky, as if complaining to the powers above of Mo's unearned fame. He liked the nickname those glasses had earned him, Four Eyes. It was whispered with fear and horror in Umbra, which pleased Orpheus even more. And the glasses were regarded as evidence that all the lies he told about his origins were the plain truth. "He came from beyond the sea," he said, "from a distant land, ruled by princes, who all had two sets of eyes, which allowed them to read their subjects' thoughts. He claimed to be a son of the king of that country, born out of wedlock, and said he'd had to flee after his own brother's wife had fallen madly in love with him."
"By the god of books, what a wretched story," Finolio had cried when Farid told Minerva's children about it. "The slushy notions churning around in that fellow's mind. He hasn't a single fresh idea in his slimy brain. All he can do is mess about with other people's stories."
But while Finolio was spending his days and nights feeling sorry for himself, Orpheus had leisure to put his own stamp on this story, and he seemed to know more about it than the man who had originally made it up. When you love a book so much that you read it again and again, do you know what it makes you wish? Orpheus had asked Farid, as they stood outside the city gate of Umbra for the first time. "No, of course you don't. How could you? I'm sure a book only makes you think how well it would burn on a cold night. But I'll tell you the answer all the same. You want to be in the book yourself. Although certainly not as a poor court poet. I'm happy to leave that role to Finolio. Though even there, he cuts a sorry figure." Orpheus had set to work the third night after he arrived, in a dirty inn near the city walls. He had told Farid to steal him some wine and a candle, and from under his cloak had produced a grubby piece of paper and a pencil, and the book, the thrice-accursed book, Inkheart. His fingers had wandered over the pages collecting words, more and more words, like magpies in search of glittering baubles. And Farid had been fool enough to believe that the words Orpheus was so busily writing on his sheet of paper would heal the pain in his heart and bring Dustfinger back. But Orpheus had very different ideas in mind. He sent Farid away before reading aloud what he had written, and before dawn the next morning ordered him to dig up his first treasure from the soil of Umbra, in the graveyard just beyond the infirmary. The sight of the coins had made Orpheus as happy as a child. But Farid had stared at the graves, tasting his own tears in his mouth. Orpheus had spent the silver on new clothes for himself, hired two maids and a cook, and bought a silk merchant's magnificent house. Its previous owner had gone away in search of his son, who had ridden with Cosimo to Argenta and never come back. Orpheus made claim that he himself was a merchant, one who sold the granting of unusual wishes. And soon it had reached the milksop's ears that this stranger with the thin fair hair and skin as pale as a prince's could supply bizarre things. Spotted brownies, fairies as brightly coloured as butterflies, jewellery made of fire elves' wings, belts set with the scales of river nymphs, gold and white piebald horses to draw princely coaches, and other creatures previously known in Umbra only from fairy tales. The right words for all sorts of things could be found in Finolio's original book of Inkheart. Orpheus just had to fit them together in a slightly different way. Now and then, one of his creations would die after taking only a few breaths, or would turn out vicious. The chunk often had bandaged hands. But that didn't bother Orpheus. Why would he mind if a few dozen fire elves died of starvation in the forest because they had no wings, or a handful of river nymphs drifted dead in the water without their scales? He pulled thread after thread out of the fine fabric that Finolio had spun and wove patterns of his own, adding them to the old man's tapestry like brightly coloured patches, and growing rich on what his voice could entice out of another man's words. Curses on him! 1,001 curses! This was too much.
I won't do anything for you anymore! I won't do anything at all!
Farid wiped the moist earth from his hands and tried to climb out of the hole, but one gesture from Orpheus and Os pushed him roughly back again.
Dig, he grunted.
Dig yourself.
Farid was trembling in his sweaty tunic, though whether with cold or rage he couldn't have said.
You're fine, master. He's just a fraud. He's already been in jail for his lies, and that's where he'll end up again.
Orpheus narrowed his eyes. He didn't like to have that chapter in his life mentioned at all.
I bet you were the sort who cons money out of old ladies' pockets. And here you are, all puffed up like a bullfrog, just because your lies are suddenly coming true. You suck up to the milksop because he's the other head's brother-in-law, and think yourself cleverer than anyone else. But what can you really do? Write fairies here who look like they've fallen into a vat of dye? Chests full of treasure? And jewelry made of elves' wings for him? But you can't do what we brought you here for. You can't do that. Dustfinger is dead. He's dead. He is still dead.
And now here came those wretched tears again. Farid wiped them away with his dirty fingers, while the chunk stared down at him as blankly as only someone who doesn't understand a word of what's being said can. And how could he? What did Os know about the words Orpheus was collecting on the sly? What did he know about the book and Orpheus's voice?
No one brought me here for anything.
Orpheus leaned over the edge of the pit, as if to spit the words into Farid's face.
And I certainly don't have to listen to any lectures about Dustfinger from the boy who caused his death. Have you forgotten how he sacrificed himself for you?
Why, I knew his name before you were even born. And I, and no one else, will bring him back after you so drastically removed him from this story. But how and when I do it will be my own decision. Now, dig! Or do you think, you brilliant example of the wisdom of Arabia?
Farid thought he felt the words slicing through him.
Do you think I'll be more likely to write if I can't pay my maids, and I have to wash my own clothes?
Damn him. Damn him to hell. Farid bowed his head so that Orpheus wouldn't see his tears. The boy who caused his death.
Tell me why I keep paying minstrels good silver for their pitiful songs. Because I've forgotten, Dustfinger? No, it's because you still haven't managed to find out how and where in this world I can speak to the white women who have him now. So I go on listening to bad songs. I stand beside dying beggars. I bribe the healers in the infirmaries to call me when a patient is at death's door.
Of course, it would be much easier if, like your master, you could summon the white women with fire. But we've tried that often enough and gotten nowhere, right? If at least they'd visit you, as it seems they like to visit those they've touched once with death already. But no. The fresh chicken blood I put outside the door was no use either. Nor were the children's bones I bought from a gravedigger for a bag of silver after the guards at the gate told you that was sure to raise 12 white women at once.
Yes, yes, Farid wanted to put his hands over his ears. Orpheus was right. They'd tried everything, but the white women simply didn't appear to them. And who else was to tell Orpheus how to bring Dustfinger back from the dead? Without a word, Farid pulled his shovel out of the ground and began digging again. He had blisters on his hands by the time he finally struck wood. The chest he pulled out of the ground wasn't very large, but like the last one, it was filled to the brim with silver coins. Farid had been listening when Orpheus read it there, under the gallows on the dark hill, long before the Prince of Sighs had the oaks there felled for his son's coffin. A band of highwaymen had buried a casket of silver in the ground. Then they killed each other in a quarrel, but the silver still lay there in the earth, with their bones bleaching above it. The wood of the chest was rotten, and as with the other treasures he had dug up, Farid wondered whether the silver might not have been lying under the gallows even before Orpheus wrote his words. If asked such questions, Cheeseface would only smile knowingly. But Farid doubted whether he really knew the answer.
There you are. Now who's talking? That ought to last another month.
Orpheus's smile was so self-satisfied that Farid would have liked to wipe it off his face with a shovelful of dirt. Another month. The silver he and the chunk were putting into leather bags would have filled the hungry bellies of everyone in Umbra for months to come.
How much longer is this going to take? The hangman's probably already on his way with fresh gallows fodder.
When Orpheus was nervous, his voice sounded less impressive. Without a word, Farid tied up another bag full to bursting, kicked the empty chest back into the pit, and gave the hanged men one last glance. There had been a gallows on the Dark Hill before, but it was the milksop who had declared it the main place of execution again. The stink of corpses drifted up to the castle too often from the gallows outside the city gate, and the stench didn't go well with the fine dishes that the Adderhead's brother-in-law ate while Umbra went hungry.
"Have you found me some minstrels for this afternoon?"
Farid just nodded as he followed Orpheus, carrying the heavy bags.
"The one you got me yesterday was ugly as sin."
Orpheus got Os to help him up onto his horse,
like a scarecrow come to life. "And most of what came out of his toothless mouth was the usual old stuff. Beautiful princess loves poor strolling player, tra-la-la. Handsome prince's son falls in love with peasant's daughter, tra-la-lee. Not a word about the white women for me to use."
Farid was only half listening. He didn't think much of the strolling players anymore. Most of them sang and danced for the milksop these days, and they had voted the Black Prince out of his position as their king because he was openly hostile to the occupying army.
"All the same," Orpheus went on, "the Scarecrow did know a couple of new songs about the Blue Jay. It cost me a pretty penny to worm them out of him, and he sang them as quietly as if the milksop in person was standing under my window. But one of them I'd really never heard before. Are you still sure Fenolio isn't writing again?"
"Perfectly sure."
Farid slung his rucksack on his back and whistled softly through his teeth, as Dustfinger always used to. Jink shot out from under the gallows with a dead mouse in his jaws. Only the younger Martin had stayed with Farid. Gwyn was with Roxanne, Dustfinger's wife, as if he wanted to be where his master was most likely to go, if Death's pale fingers really did give him up.
"Just why are you so sure?"
Orpheus twisted his mouth in distaste as Jink jumped up on Farid's shoulder and disappeared inside the rucksack. Cheeseface disliked the Martin, but tolerated him, presumably because he had once belonged to Dustfinger.
"Rosenquart says he isn't writing anymore, and as Fenolia's glassman he should know, right?"
In fact, Rosenquartz was always complaining of his hard life now that Fenolia was back in Minerva's attic room, and Farid himself cursed the steep wooden staircase every time Orpheus sent him to question Fenolio about things that Orpheus couldn't find in his original book. What lands lay south of the sea bordering Argenta? Is the prince who rules northern Lombrica related to the Adderhead's wife? Where exactly do the giants live, or have they died out now? Do the predatory fish in the rivers eat river nymphs? Sometimes Fenolia wouldn't even let Farid in after he'd toiled up all those stairs, but now and then he would have drunk so much that he was in a talkative mood. On those days, the old man overwhelmed him with such a torrent of information that Farid's head was spinning by the time he came back to Orpheus, who then questioned him all over again.
"It was enough to drive you crazy."
But every time Orpheus and Fenolio tried communicating with each other directly, they started to quarrel within a few minutes.
"Good. Excellent. It would complicate matters if the old man took to liking words better than wine again."
His last notions led to nothing but hopeless confusion. Orpheus picked up the reins and looked at the sky. It was going to be another rainy day, grey and dismal as the faces of the people of Umbra. Masked robbers, books of immortality, a prince returning from the dead. Shaking his head, he rode his horse toward the path to Umbra. Who knows what he'd have thought up next?
Better for Fenolio to drink away what few wits he has left. I'll see to his story myself. After all, I understand it a great deal better than he does.
Farid had stopped listening as he dragged his donkey out of the bushes.
Let Cheeseface talk away, for Reed didn't care who wrote the words to bring Dustfinger back, just so long as he did come back in the end. Even if the whole wretched story went to hell in the process. As usual, the donkey tried to bite Farid when he swung himself up onto its bony back. Cheeseface was riding one of the finest horses in Umbra. Despite his pudgy figure, he was a good horseman. But of course, miserly as he was, he'd bought only a donkey for Farid, a vicious animal so old that its head was bald. Even two donkeys couldn't have carried the chunk, so Os trotted along beside Orpheus like an overgrown dog, his face sweating with the effort of running up and down the narrow paths through the hills around Umbra. Good. So Fenolio isn't writing anymore. Orpheus liked to think out loud. It sometimes seemed as if he couldn't put his ideas in order unless he heard his own voice at the same time. But where do all the stories about the blue jay come from then? The widows he protects, silver left on poor folks' doorsteps, poached meat on the plates of fatherless children? Is all that really Moe's own doing? Or did Fenolio write a few words by way of giving him a helping hand? A cart came toward them. Cursing, Orpheus turned his horse toward the thorny bushes, and the chunk stared up with a silly grin at the two boys kneeling in the cart, hands tied behind their backs, faces pinched with fear. One of them had eyes even brighter than Meggy's, and neither was older than Farid. Of course not. If they'd been older, they would have gone with Cosimo on the disastrous expedition against the Adderhead that got all the men killed, and they'd be dead by now too. But presumably that was no comfort to them this morning. Their bodies would be visible from Umbra, a dreadful example to all who were tempted by hunger to go poaching. Did people die on the gallows too quickly for the white women to come? Farid instinctively put his hand to his back, where Bastar's knife had gone in. They hadn't come to him, had they? He didn't remember. He didn't even remember the pain, only Meggy's face when he regained consciousness, and how he had turned to see Dustfinger lying there.
"Why don't you just write that they come and take me away instead of him?" he had asked Orpheus, who merely laughed out loud.
"You? Do you seriously think the white women would exchange the fire dancer for a rascally thief like you? No! We'll have to offer them tastier bait than that."
The bags of silver jogged up and down beside Orpheus's saddle as he spurred his horse on, and Os's face was so red with effort that it looked as if it would explode on his fleshy neck any moment now.
Curses on Cheeseface. Yes, Meggy had better send him back to his own world, thought Farid as he dug his heels into the donkey's sides. And the sooner the better.
But who was going to write the words for her, and who but Orpheus could bring Dustfinger back from the dead?
"He'll never come back,"
a voice whispered inside him.
"Dustfinger is dead, Farid. Dead."
"So?" he snapped back at the quiet voice.
"What does that mean in this world? I came back, didn't I?"
If only he could remember the way. Chapter 4 Ink Clothes. A new morning woke Meggy, with pale light that fell on her face and air as fresh as if no one had ever breathed it before. The fairies were twittering outside her window like birds that had learned to talk, and a blue jay screeched somewhere, if it really was a blue jay. The strong man could imitate any bird's call so well that it sounded as if the real thing were nesting in his broad chest. And they all answered him, larks, mockingbirds, woodpeckers, nightingales, and geckos, tame crows. Mo was awake, too. She heard his voice outside, and her mother's. Could Farid have come at last? She quickly rose from the straw mattress she slept on, what had sleeping in a bed felt like she could hardly remember, and went to the window. She'd been waiting for Farid for days. He had promised to come. However, she saw no one out in the yard but her parents and the strong man, who smiled at her when he saw her standing at the window. Mo was helping Risa to saddle one of the horses that had been waiting in the stables when they first came here. The horses were so beautiful that they must once have belonged to one of the milksop's high-born friends. But as with many of the things the Black Prince brought, Maggie tried not to think too much about how they fell into the robber's hands. She loved the Black Prince, Batista, and the strong man, but some of the others sent a shudder down her spine. Men like Snapper and Gecko, for instance, although the same men had rescued her and her parents on Mount Ada.
"Robbers are robbers, Maggie," Fareed often said. "The prince does what he does for other people, but several of his men just want to fill their pockets without having to toil in the fields or in a workshop."
Fareed, she missed him so much that she felt ashamed of it. Her mother was looking pale. Risa had often been sick over the last few days. That must be why she wanted to ride over and see Roxanne. No one knew what to do in such cases better than Dustfinger's widow, except perhaps for the barn owl. But he himself hadn't been particularly well since the death of Dustfinger, and especially since the Adderhead had burned down the infirmary he'd run for so many years on the other side of the forest. No one knew what had become of Bella and all the other healers there. A mouse, horned like Dustfinger's Martin, scurried past as Maggie went outside, and a fairy whirred toward her and snatched at her hair. But by now Maggie knew just how to shoo them away. The colder the weather, the fewer fairies ventured out of their nests, but they were still on the hunt for human hair.
"Nothing keeps them warmer," Batista always said, "except for bear's hair, and it's dangerous to pull that out."
The morning was so cool that Maggie wrapped her arms around herself shivering. The clothes the robbers had found for them weren't as warm as the sweaters she'd have worn on a day like this in the other world, and she thought almost wistfully of the warm socks waiting for her in Eleanor's cupboards. Mo turned and smiled as she came toward him. He looked tired but happy to see her. He wasn't sleeping much. Often he would work late into the night in his makeshift workshop, using the few tools that Fenolio had found him. And he was always going out into the forest, either alone or with the prince. He thought Maggie didn't know, but several times when she had been standing by the window, unable to sleep, waiting for Fareed, she had seen the robbers come for him. They called to Mo with the blue jay's cry. Maggie heard it almost every night.
"Are you feeling any better?"
She looked at her mother anxiously.
"Perhaps it was those mushrooms we found the other day."
"No, it definitely wasn't the mushrooms." Risa looked at Mo and smiled.
"Roxanne is sure to know a herb that will help. Would you like to come with me? Brianna might be there. She doesn't work for Orpheus every day."
"Brianna? Why would Maggie want to see her? Because they were almost the same age? After Cosimo's death and the massacre of Umbra's menfolk, her ugliness had thrown Brianna out as a belated punishment for having favored Cosimo's company over hers. So Brianna had come home to help Roxanne in the fields at first, but now she was working for Orpheus, just like Fareed. By this time, Orpheus had half a dozen maids. Fareed said sarcastically that Cheeseface didn't even have to comb his own thin hair anymore. Orpheus hired only beautiful girls, and Brianna was very beautiful. So beautiful that beside her, Maggie felt like a duck next to a swan. To make it even worse, Brianna was Dustfinger's daughter.
"So? I don't even speak to her,"
Fareed had said when Maggie asked about her.
"She hates me, just like her mother."
Still, he saw Brianna almost every day, and all the others. And it was almost 2 weeks since he had been to see Maggie. "Well, are you coming with me?" Risa was still looking inquiringly at her, and Maggie felt herself blushing as if her mother had overheard all her thoughts.
"No," she said. "No, I think I'd rather stay here. The strong man will be riding with you, won't he?"
"Of course." The strong man had made it his business to protect Maggie and Risa. Maggie wasn't sure whether Mo had asked him to, or whether he simply did it to show his devotion to the Blue Jay. Risa let him help her up onto the horse. She often complained of the difficulty of riding in a dress, and how she'd much rather have worn men's clothes in this world. "I'll be back before dark," she told Mo, "and maybe Roxanne will have something to help you sleep better at night, too." Then she disappeared among the trees with the strong man, and Maggie was alone with Mo, just as she had been in the old days when there were only the two of them.
"She really isn't well."
"Don't worry, Roxanne will know what to do."
Mo glanced at the old bakehouse that he had made into his workshop.
What were those black clothes he was wearing, Maggie wondered.
"I have to go out myself,
but I'll be back this evening. Gecko and Batista are in the stables, and the prince is going to send Woodenfoot to be here too while the strongman's gone. Those three will look after you better than I can.